More action.
More action.
More updates.
More updates.
The news you need now.
You need it now.
MRAP. Breaking news.
We're gonna break it.
Another year, another virus. But is this novel coronavirus just another virus? Or is it something that we need to be really worried about? Based on all the media coverage, the CDC, the WHO, we clearly need to at least be a little worried. And especially as first-line providers, we need to know how to recognize it and what to do about the virus if we have a case where we suspect it. To try to get a handle on this, I've got Dr. Isaac Bogosh, internist and ID doc at the University Health Network in Toronto, here to discuss it all. Isaac, welcome to MRAP.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So, Isaac, I have a lot of questions about this novel coronavirus, and I saw that you have been on TV in Canada, you've been on the radio, you are telling everybody what to know about this virus. You seem like the perfect person to get into it. Are you ready to dive into all these questions?
I'm ready. I mean, I hope I have some of the answers. I certainly don't have all of them, but let's dive in.
All right, let's go. From what I remember, coronaviruses are pretty common and frequently cause cold-like symptoms. So what's novel about this particular coronavirus?
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the coronaviruses are, you know, the list of coronaviruses is longer than my arm. There's tons of them. And as you point out, many of them are just associated with the common cold. And certainly those would be at the more benign end of the spectrum. But of course, we know there's other coronaviruses as well that can cause much more serious illness. And those would be the ones like SARS and MERS. So those are at the more severe end of the spectrum. And, you know, if we look at the current novel coronavirus that emerged from Wuhan, you know, it's clearly not as bad as SARS or MERS, but of course, it's not a common cold either. So it's probably going to land somewhere in the middle.
This particular virus, as you mentioned, started in Wuhan City in China. Do we know how it got into humans?
It's very, very likely that this jumped into humans from close contact with a non-human animal. So this is one of those zoonotic infections. You know, it's likely at the seafood market in Wuhan, there was a close contact with a non-human animal, and this jumped from the non-human animal into humans. You know, at the end of the day, it's probably going to be from a bat, but currently it's not entirely clear.
There's been a lot of comparisons, as you mentioned, with the 2003 SARS virus outbreak, as well as the 2015 MERS outbreak. How does the 2019 coronavirus compare with these viruses?
Yeah, I mean, there's some obvious similarities, but I think there's some major differences as well. And, you know, the similarities between this and SARS are that, you know, they're both zoonotic infections. They both emerged probably from a market in China. And of course, they're both started an epidemic. But I think that's where a lot of the similarities end. And, you know, this virus has, certainly a different clinical spectrum than SARS did. And, you know, we can jump into that a little bit later. But, you know, it doesn't look like it's as severe as an infection as SARS. I think the other thing, too, is, you know, the world is a much, much different place than it was in 2002 at the beginning of SARS. And, you know, certainly a lot has been said about the communication and coordination around this epidemic. You know, it's night and day compared to 2002. I mean, we had the virus sequenced and made public to the world only about 2 weeks after we knew this virus existed, thanks to some of the Chinese scientists that were working on it. The pace of discovery and the pace of communication with the world is essentially unprecedented. So there's also a lot of differences between this epidemic and prior ones.
Every day we see increasing numbers of patients that are being diagnosed with this, but do we have any real grasp on the incidence of this infection?
Yeah, I mean, that's extremely tricky. And, you know, I think we have some good mathematical modelers who are looking at to what the true burden of disease is in China and elsewhere around the world. And of course, we have to timestamp all of these conversations because this is moving rather quickly and things are clearly changing day by day. But, you know, as of today, there's about 25,000 confirmed cases and just over 500 deaths associated with this. But really, the belief is that there are significantly more cases that just aren't being reported for a variety of reasons. You know, number one, there might be a selection bias and only the sicker individuals are seeking medical care and getting diagnosed. There's also, you know, there might be limitations in healthcare capacity and how many people can get tested currently in Wuhan and Hubei province and elsewhere in China. And it also might be reflective of how data is reported, you know, instead of trickling in, it might be reported in chunks. So there's a lot of different reasons why we're seeing the case numbers that we are and that they might not be reflective of the true burden of disease in China.
Now, along with incidence, the other thing we always want to look at is mortality rates. Now, SARS and MERS had relatively high mortality rates. What are we looking at with this particular virus in terms of mortality?
Yeah, we have to be really careful about extrapolating too much information from the existing data. And if we look at the existing data, it says, you know, the case fatality rate is about 2-ish%. But, you know, this is going to change. And certainly, even throughout the course of this epidemic, we've seen the case fatality rate drop. So earlier on, we had some reports from, you know, there's a really well done study that was published in The Lancet that just looked at hospitalized individuals. And that showed about a case fatality rate of about 11%, which we know is helpful for hospitalized patients, but clearly that's not reflective of the whole spectrum of illness. And now there's like a growing narrative and emerging data that people can have much more mild infections and certainly not even be sick enough to seek medical care. And, you know, unfortunately, those individuals who are symptomatic but not sick enough to seek medical care are contributing to the transmission of this infection. But on the other hand, it probably will lower the case fatality rate, you know, hopefully well below 2%. So I think, you know, it's premature to really say what the case fatality rate is because we just don't have the full denominator of the number of infected individuals. But I suspect, and many suspect, that it will be a lot lower than the 2% that's currently reported.
Isaac, let's bridge from there into some of the more practical things that we need to know. Let's start with symptoms. What symptoms are these patients typically manifesting with when they present for medical care?
Many of them in some of the published studies are just showing, you know, very classic respiratory viral infection symptoms. So fever, cough, shortness of breath. And, you know, while that's rather general, I think what we've seen too in the data that's emerging from China is that the degree of severity can vary. And, you know, some people sadly are hospitalized with their fever, cough, and shortness of breath and develop ARDS and require intensive care unit level care. Whereas others that we've seen are managed as outpatients and don't necessarily require hospitalization. So there is a full, a very broad spectrum of illness with this. I think the key is, you know, what is the proportion of patients that are mild versus moderate versus severely affected by this virus? And we certainly don't know that. But fever, cough, and shortness of breath are going to be the biggies. I think the other challenge too is, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's influenza season. And certainly in many parts of the world, we're having rather difficult influenza seasons with a lot of cases of confirmed influenza A and influenza B. And, you know, this is one of those infections where, like, we're not going to percuss our way out of this one. Like, it's going to be very challenging to distinguish clinically, you know, is this the novel coronavirus or is this a, you know, other garden variety upper respiratory tract infection? So I think history is everything. History is everything. You know, have you been to China in the last 2 weeks, or have you possibly been in contact with an infected individual in the last 2 weeks? And do you have these, you know, compatible signs and symptoms like fever, cough, and shortness of breath? And if that's the case, you know, I think we have to certainly suspect the novel coronavirus in those instances.
Yeah, Isaac, my hospital, as I'm sure yours is too, is full with flu patients. The other night I was working and we actually had every single BiPAP, CPAP machine on patients with influenza because they were having exacerbations of their COPD, their asthma, their CHF, and they needed that support. And we are flooded with flu. And within all of that flu, we need to find these novel coronavirus patients or the ones that we're suspecting that they could have the novel coronavirus. And it's what you said exactly. It's honing in on that history and making sure you ask those questions. I think most hospitals have been very good about this, but if your hospital isn't doing it, this screening needs to be done in triage. You really don't want the person getting back into your general ED population before they're getting screened, because if they're symptomatic, they're infecting everyone back there as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And certainly I'm sitting in Toronto chatting about this, but, you know, in 2003, we had the SARS epidemic here in Toronto, and there were some very notable cases of hospital transmission of SARS because of exactly what you speak of. So, you know, impeccable infection prevention and control measures are just essential to really ensure that there's no transmission of this virus in healthcare settings. And, you know, there's been a huge push to really ensure that frontline healthcare providers, regardless of where they practice, are aware of what this virus is, how it's transmitted, and really ensuring people adhere to the highest standards of infection prevention and control measures.
So you just mentioned it again. Transmission is obviously one of our biggest concerns. There was a recent published report in the New England Journal of Medicine about transmission from an asymptomatic patient. Obviously, this has a lot of serious implications, but there's also been some question of the veracity of this particular research. So can there be asymptomatic carrier transmission of this coronavirus?
You know, I read, just like the rest of the world read, that report in the New England Journal of Medicine. But, you know, subsequent to that, it sort of came out where the person who was thought to be asymptomatic indeed had symptoms. And it's now reported that that individual had some muscle aches and pains. They weren't feeling that well. And in fact, that individual was reported to be taking fever-lowering medications. I believe it was paracetamol. That's not asymptomatic. That is not asymptomatic. That is a symptomatic individual. Now, I think the question is, you know, can an asymptomatic individual transmit this infection to another person? I think the answer to that is maybe, probably. I mean, it's hard to be dogmatic here. It's hard to be overconfident here because we've only known this virus has existed for less than 2 months. So, of course, we're learning more and more about the biology and the transmission of this virus. But the other question is, you know, who's more likely to transmit infection? Who is driving the epidemic? And, you know, with respiratory viruses, that, you know, that's usually symptomatic people. These are people who are coughing and able to transmit the virus to others through droplets. These droplets can land on surfaces, and other people may be able to pick up that virus on surfaces as well if there's a symptomatic person coughing the virus out. So the question about asymptomatic transmission, I think, is still open. Of course, we have to be skeptical about this. We have to see some good data. But I don't think it would come to anyone's surprise that it's typically the symptomatic individuals that are causing more transmission and usually driving epidemics.
So let's say that I have a patient with cough, fever, and myalgias. Not too uncommon, but the patient also has the right travel or exposure history. What should I be doing in the ED as far as management at that point?
Certainly, every hospital is going to have their own protocols in place, and, you know, their IPAC teams are going to have local protocols to adhere to. But in general, you know, those individuals have a mask placed over them. They're usually placed in an isolation room. Here, we're using airborne isolation with contact precautions. And the infection prevention and control team is alerted right away and is actively involved in the care of these individuals. I think the key thing here is that we have to remember this is a team sport. No one's in this alone, and everyone's going to play a role, but we really do need to work as a team. And certainly the ED physician or the frontline healthcare provider is going to be seeing this patient and have to recognize that they're not already recognized at triage. But in order to facilitate, you know, diagnoses and assist with management, it's going to be a team effort.
And Isaac, what are we doing as far as diagnostic testing at this point? If I have a patient where I suspect I have a high suspicion, I've already isolated them, who am I calling to get that specific diagnostic testing done?
I think it's also important for people to really know what the protocols are at their local hospitals, because this is probably going to differ between different centers. But, you know, for example, in Canada, the infection prevention and control team will help and work closely with the emergency department on facilitating diagnostic testing. And, you know, we have protocols that are really based on WHO guidelines and adhere to evolving standards related to this virus. But, you know, we will currently be getting nasopharyngeal swabs and throat swabs and sputum samples as well. And here in Canada, they're typically sent to the provincial health lab, which is our public health body, for testing. And then there's subsequent testing that performed at a very centralized lab for the whole country that's based in Winnipeg. I know in the United States, the CDC has validated diagnostic tests. And now there's, if not already, there is talk about ensuring that there's less centralization of this. So these tests can be done in many different settings rather than just in one setting.
For right now in the US, I think we are supposed to contact our local Department of Health. They're going to contact the CDC to get testing done. But you're right, this is evolving very rapidly, and this could change tomorrow. It could change next week. There probably will be some more local ability to test, which obviously will speed up the process of making the diagnosis. So it's going to be really helpful. And you're going to just have to follow along, talk to your hospital admin, find out what the changes are. I don't know how it is at your hospital, Isaac, but I think every 2 to 3 days, we get an update from our infectious control people saying, here's the new policy, and here's what you're going to do if you need to test anybody. So I think that's very helpful, but you got to stay on top of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like anything else, this is a rapidly evolving epidemic, and, you know, standards will change. And it's just a great idea to keep in touch and have open and transparent communication with the hospital, but also with the local public health teams to really ensure that people know exactly what to do if they're managing a potentially imported case.
For right now, Isaac, if I have a patient, I have a suspicion, I'm going to start with supportive care. So IV fluids, if they need them, give them something to lower their fever, make them more comfortable, contact my local health department to get the testing done. And then you said for isolation, you guys are doing airborne plus contact. Now, I always get confused with airborne and droplet. So let's just make sure that we're very explicit here. Airborne, are we talking just a standard surgical mask that we're putting on the patient on ourselves and then any room that's putting them in a room by themselves? Or is it more than that?
No, this is the negative pressure rooms with the N95 masks. Again, that's what's being done here. I mean, different places might have different systems that are being used, but currently here we're using negative pressure rooms with the N95 masks.
I think that's really important to make very clear to people. If you have a case where you're suspicious, put them in negative pressure. Anyone who's going in that room should have an N95 mask. If at all possible, you should probably reduce the number of people who are going in and out of that room, since we're still developing more information of what protection is going to be ideal. And I've seen some recent patient information about if you have to actively manage the patient's airway, what you should be doing as far as protection. I think the N95 mask is a good place to start, but you're going to want some kind of eye protection as well. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. I've been in touch with several intensivists and emergency room physicians who have been having this discussion. And, you know, it's really interesting to see how the protocols for this have rapidly evolved and taken shape. But certainly we're at institutions in Toronto. The recommendation is, you know, N95 mask, proper eye protection, negative pressure room. And you know, like anything else, I think we just have to stay up to date because this might change as we have more information with this evolving epidemic.
Isaac, one of the things that you see everywhere when you're walking around, if you're in any public location, you're at the airport, is the general public wearing masks. Not everybody, obviously, but lots of people are wearing masks that they're buying at the drugstore, some at the hardware store. Do any of the commercially available masks help to prevent transmission?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of drives me crazy for a couple of reasons. So number one, we also have to put everything in perspective. And, you know, for example, currently in Canada, we have 5 confirmed cases. And, you know, this is in a country of 38 million people and the second largest country on earth. So the risk of acquiring this novel coronavirus infection here in Canada is about 0%. And I would say the same for almost every other country on earth. The risk is extraordinarily low. Of course, you know, we have to timestamp these conversations and we know this epidemic is evolving. But currently, the risk in just about every other country on earth is close to 0%. So I think we have to question the utility of wearing these masks to protect ourselves from this novel coronavirus infection. Having said that, it doesn't mean we have to be complacent. We still have to keep an eye on this. This is still an epidemic and this is still evolving. But currently, you know, the risk of acquiring a novel coronavirus infection, you know, in Canada, the United States, and in most other countries in the world is close to 0%. So, you know, if people are wearing masks for that purpose, I think, you know, we have to sort of question the overall utility there. Secondly, you know, in general, for respiratory tract infections, especially respiratory viral infections, you know, if someone has an infection and they're wearing a mask, the mask can, you know, help reduce the spread of that infection and reduce the risk of infecting other people around them. But if people are not infected and they're wearing these, you know, flimsy surgical masks that have been reused and they think that that's going to protect them from acquiring a respiratory tract infection, they don't really significantly reduce that risk. So the utility of them is rather limited. Then I think there's another point too, is like, it kind of stokes unnecessary fear as well. I mean, it doesn't seem to be, in my opinion, an appropriate thing to do at this point.
Isaac, that's a ton of information about this coronavirus. And I just want to bring some of the really important points home. I think number one is that we as frontline providers need to stay on top of the information as it's coming in. So check the CDC, check the WHO, and then also check your local hospital because they are adapting and moving on what's coming out from the national services to know what is the best thing to do. For right now, we should be screening patients in triage, asking them if they've been to Wuhan City or if they've been in contact with someone who's under investigation for this novel coronavirus. And again, this isn't any patient who has flu-like symptoms, any patient with cough, with rhinorrhea, with fevers, with myalgias. We need to be asking those travel questions because it's all in the history. If you have a suspected case, put them in a negative isolation room. So you're going to do airborne and contact precautions for any provider going into the room, N95 mask, a face shield, something to protect your mucous membranes. And that's the best way for us to prevent the nosocomial spread of this disease. And we have to be very careful about that, especially in the hospital where we have very susceptible patients to any virus. And this one in particular could be really harmful for them. So we need to be very careful about protecting ourselves from getting sick and then protecting our other patients from getting sick as well. We have no specific management at this point, so it is supportive care. That's what we're going to be focused on. And once again, it's really going to be important for us to protect ourselves and keep on top of what the latest data is. And as this moves, as this changes, Isaac, we're going to bring you back on to give us updates as we go through it. I hope you're okay with that.
Oh, I'm happy to chat.
All right, Isaac, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me. Have a good one.